Dakota salutes those who served. Veterans ride free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of COTA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use COTA Plus. Veterans ride free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on COTA. Plan your ride and learn more at COTA.com/trip planner.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
The Market Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell.
Well, welcome back to the Market Musings podcast, where our guest today, Charles Archer, a freelance financial analyst who does lots of writing and work for IG, Investing Review and Share Talk. It's the first time we are welcoming Charles on to the podcast. So welcome. How are you doing, Charles?
Not too bad, Mark. How are you? What have you been up to today?
I'm very good, thank you. Oh, just a little bit, doing some interviews, a couple of interviews today. It's a little bit quiet, generally. In the markets, I think, for our output, and it's probably only going to get even more quieter as we head into that famous sell in May and stay away. But we'll talk about a lot of these things today, I think, in the podcast. I mean, how are you generally finding it? Because you do a lot of work, you do a lot of writing for companies in this space. So how are you seeing, you know, workload and the interest in the markets at the moment?
I think the workload hasn't really let up for me since the pandemic began in March 2020. Mm-hmm. But I think the type of content that gets written around this time of year changes. So what I'm doing at the moment is more evergreen stuff for most of my clients. So it's going to be relevant for a long period of time.
Okay.
Whereas in the sort of autumn and winter, when everybody's investing and it's freezing cold and raining outside and there's not much else to do, people want kind of reactive content. And that's what I've been focusing on up until about a couple of weeks ago.
Okay, excellent. Oh, well, that's good to hear. It's good to hear. So we're going to cover a few things today, and hopefully we'll be getting you back on the podcast in the future to talk about lots of other things. But I think, first of all, I just want to really get your opinion on the macro, or the key macro things at the moment that are topical, that are on your mind, that are on the minds of the people in the space. What's going on in the global economy? We hear about potentially another banking crisis. The Fed is saying, there's not going to be a recession. Oh, actually, there might be a very small recession. You know, there's a lot of mixed feelings, I think, with what's going on. Of course, we're in an inflationary environment at the moment. Some will say it's peaked. Some will say that is not the case and it's only going to go up again. Mm-hmm. The cost of living is certainly a thing. You can feel that now on the street. Generally, I think everyone is feeling that. You know, just talking to friends and family, people are definitely feeling that money is tighter. So that's definitely something to consider. But I mean, give us a bit of a high level overview of what you think of the state of the economy, the state of the nation, and some of the macro events that are going on.
I think we can start with the banking crisis. Obviously, sure. We had Silicon Valley Bank and Credit Suisse, which I covered in depth. Obviously, those banks collapsed a couple of weeks ago. I think that you now have this kind of intermediary period where people are saying, okay, there might be outflows from the regional banks in the US, and there may be more problems caused by these higher interest rates, but everything's kind of fine. I think that if you look back in 2008, Bear Stearns collapsed, there was problems in the market, and then actually everything started rising, everything was fine again. 8 months later, you have Lehman Brothers, Norman Rock, and everything goes to hell. Now, I'm not saying that'll definitely happen again, but I do think when it comes to banking, especially high-level banking of these system-critical banks, you never know, because there's so much data, exactly what's going on. The only thing you can be certain about is that there's more high-level stuff going on behind the scenes than what you know. Regarding inflation and interest rates, the UK's inflation is obviously still 10.4%. It's hopefully going to fall 7 a.m. tomorrow morning to below double digits, but obviously is more than five times currently what the official target is of the Bank of England. It's high. You know, our inflation is higher than in Europe, higher than in the US, higher than in Australia. So you might find the Bank of England has to continue to increase interest rates using their sledgehammer, which is the only tool that they have in order to combat this inflation. And the problem is that our inflation is special compared to the rest of the world, I think predominantly for two reasons. The first is supply chain issues exacerbated by Brexit. It's not a political opinion. It's just a fact that we import a lot of our inflation. And therefore, when you create some kind of regulatory problems on the borders, you're going to see inflation increase. And the second is worker shortages. I know that's kind of eased up with numbers today, but there are not enough workers for the positions available, and therefore you see wages increase. So we saw wages, I think average wages annually increase 6% in figures today, which is more than what analysts were expecting. So you have this wage price spiral baking in some inflation into the economy. And then in addition, you have higher inflation caused by Brexit. And those two things together are pushing our inflation higher than the rest of the world in the UK.
Okay.
And I think it's going to stay stickier for longer, and ergo higher interest rates. But that's just one person's opinion.
Indeed, it is one person's opinion. You ask 10 economists their opinion, you get 15 different answers, as the famous saying goes. But you say there, so potentially in the UK anyway, the inflation is sticking around longer and banks continuing to raise interest rates. But how long can this go on for? Because if people are starting to feel the pinch now, you know, with incomes being squeezed, how much further can they go?
I don't know. It's the short answer. I don't think it's useful for anybody to predict. Nobody has a crystal ball. If you look at where we thought, for example, house prices might go when the pandemic struck, everybody thought they would collapse. Instead, they soared to record highs. If you see interest rates, okay, so December 2021, we were at 0.1%. We're now at 4.25%. That's a more than 4,000% increase in the cost of debt. And it seems to have done not very much to our inflation, given that we're still in double digits. Now, the Office for Budget Responsibility has said that they believe that our CPI inflation is going to go down to 2.9% by the end of the year. It's possible that we will avoid a technical recession, because we won't have two quarters of negative growth in a row, even though we may have quarters of negative growth throughout the next sort of eight quarters or so. They won't be consecutive. But I don't believe that with the inflationary factors that we have, that inflation is going to go down to 2.9% by the end of the year. I think that it may drop to sort of 6 or 7% and then stay there, because wage expectations are baking this inflation into the economy. I think if you look at the period between sort of mid-2022 until now, after the shocks of Ukraine war, this should have been one of the most deflationary periods in history. You should have seen, in my view, prices coming down. Obviously, you had supply chains opening up with the China reopening. Pandemic stopped, and therefore the world reopened up. And yet that hasn't happened. And obviously, a lot of the inflation that we have now is about the price of oil, which is obviously elevated by historical levels. Or comparisons, I think that oil will probably collapse in the next sort of year or two. But until it does, our inflation is going to stay high.
Okay, so inflation is going to stay high, and that means that central banks will probably continue to try and fight that inflation by raising interest rates. So in theory, life for your average person is probably going to get tougher. What does it mean for the stock market then? I mean, does that mean there's been more of a risk-off environment, so less capital to go in? I mean, we saw the COVID crisis, where all that bubble money came from. Clearly, it came from people who were at home with nowhere to spend the money and the free money that the government was giving out. So we saw that bubble increase because of lots of money there. But your average person is not going to be, your average PI is not going to be here this time. They're not going to have the money to put into the market. So how does this continuing sticky inflation and continuing to the rising of interest rates, which I do think the Fed will also continue to go down that track. How will that affect the stock market then, and the investing appetite, do you think?
Well, I think the Fed is going to have at least another couple more rises. Mm. If you look at in the UK, the ONS said that we had £140 billion of excess savings throughout the pandemic. A lot of that money went into housing. Some of it went into the stock market. I think that you're just going to find that the house prices, and again, making house price predictions is not a good idea because nobody ever seems to know exactly what's going to happen. But I think that the amount that people can borrow is falling drastically, and the vast majority of houses in this country are bought with a mortgage.
Mm.
So, and I think something that a lot of people don't quite get is that even though there's, you know, half of the country owns the house outright without a mortgage, when they put it up for sale, the price is dictated by the 1% of people buying at that time and their access to credit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when it comes to the stock market, it's a really tricky situation at the moment. I did tell a lot of people in at the start of 2022 that the FTSE 100 would outperform, whereas US tech stocks would suffer because US tech stocks rely on cheap monetary policy to grow exponentially, whereas FTSE 100 stocks like higher monetary policy because it tends to, you tend to see alongside that higher oil prices, higher commodity prices, higher interest rates, obviously, and those are the kind of things that affect FTSE 100 stocks. Now you have a situation whereby the S&P 500, the NASDAQ have recovered to some extent. The FTSE 100 could potentially be overvalued. So if you're a private investor and say you've just got your bonus, for example, because it's, you know, just after the end of a tax year, where you put that money, it's very difficult because you have a situation where you don't know whether the bottom is in for growth. Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't know whether you should put it in the FTSE 100, which at 7,900-ish points is almost back to its record high. When growth comes back, same with gold. Gold's at a record high. You put your money into gold, you put the money into FTSE 100. When growth comes back, the money falls out of those, that commodity and those kind of dividend stocks, and goes straight back into growth, and you might find yourself holding the bags. So I, which is why I'm focusing on FTSE AIM stocks at the moment, because they tend to be less affected by the macro.
Okay.
The index itself, so the FTSE AIM's down about 20% over the past year, but the individual stocks, it's all about their individual and very specific investment cases. And I think that it's a lot easier with those kind of companies to know or to predict where the share prices are going to go versus, for example, BP or Shell, which is dictated by the oil price, where there's a thousand different things feeding into the oil price. It's very difficult to predict where it's going to go. Or say Tesla or Amazon or Alphabet, where their share prices are dictated by monetary policy. And again, you say the Fed is going to, or you predict without investing advice, we say it's likely the Fed will continue to increase interest rates.
Yeah.
And therefore you would expect that their share prices will fall. However, the past few times when this sort of thing has happened in the US, what actually happens is that the Federal Reserve only pauses or pivots on monetary policy when there's like a real crisis.
Mm.
And therefore you find when the share, when the interest rates start to fall in the US, it isn't a good thing for tech stocks, because actually it's because there's some kind of chaotic black swan event. So making predictions on it is very tricky.
Very tricky, yeah. But I mean, the Fed have got, if they've got two choices, which is to either let hyperinflation come into effect and effectively de-dollarize the world, which they don't want, obviously not, but we hear talk of the new BRICS currency, the yuan, maybe wanting to take that position. China flexing their muscles around Taiwan. We see a lot of stuff coming from this side of the world that they really do want to try and push the West and the US dollar and all that under pressure. The US is not going to want to let that fail. So what's their choice? Either let it fail and have terrible times because no one can afford anything, and it's the 1929 depression, everyone is in super high inflation, or you keep raising the rates and you have to let this reset happen and the stock market reset. That's a choice, isn't it?
It is the choice. The problem is, obviously, is that you've printed so much money and you've created these, a lot of institutions, not just Credit Suisse or Silicon Valley Bank, there are a lot of institutions and a lot of companies where if you continue to increase interest rates, and I do think they are going to continue, even though you're bringing value back into the dollar that's been missing for the past few years, you are risking there being another system critical company or bank, you know, going under. You mentioned Taiwan there. I've done a fair bit of research into it. I don't think we can go into too much detail, but one of the things that I there's a lot of people comparing Russia's invasion of Ukraine with a potential Chinese invasion of Taiwan. And it's really tempting to do that because obviously they're both territories that, you know, each respective country wants to, you know, extend their sphere of control over. I think, though, there are a few key differences. Taiwan obviously has massive defenses. It has this mountainous, hilly range throughout this very small island that it has, which is very difficult to attack. Ukraine is this, you know, got a 1,400-mile border with Russia. It's a flat country. But I think the biggest thing, more than sort of weapons or anything else, is that if you're attacking Ukraine, you're going for the oil, the gas, the iron deposits that the country has, and also, you know, to prevent NATO from expanding. That's the Russian perspective anyway, in my view. Whereas with China, they want to take Taiwan because they feel like it's, you know, Chinese territory. And since 1949, they've pretty much hated the ROC government, who they view as their enemy. But Taiwan manufactures about 90% of the world's semiconductors and 60% of the most advanced semiconductors. So in order to take the island, you'd have to destroy those factories, which would collapse the global economy because the world runs on semiconductors. And would collapse the Chinese economy as well. So while I think they would desperately like to do it, they know that the porcupine strategy around Taiwan, and again, this is not investing advice, and I'm not a military strategist, but I know that in order to take the island, they'd have to destroy the one thing that makes it valuable. So it makes no sense for them to do that. Having said that, when Russia invaded Ukraine, I don't think any analysts thought that Putin would actually go through with it.
No.
So there's often a personal element to it as well that you can't really quantify.
Absolutely. But I mean, what can we do? What can investors do who are looking at the different opportunities at the moment? Are there any leading signs? They often say, don't they, that bonds are the one to follow, aren't
they? We're talking about.
We've had junk bonds, haven't we, selling off last week. And I think sort of towards the end of last week, we had a lot of volatility there. But I mean, I don't know. Are there any kind of things you can look at, signs you can look at to... You can't predict, but to, you know, to give an idea of what's going on, you look at things like, I look at things like the volatility index, very, very low.
The VIX.
VIX, very, very low at the moment. The dollar, you know, looking like it is potentially wanting to go into a breakout. You've mentioned gold at all-time high. So there's quite a few things at kind of interesting levels, I think, at the moment.
Well, I think with bonds, I think the vast majority of investors invest in bonds as an inflationary hedge. Which has worked out well this year and most of last year. I think if I were talking about long-term investing, and I'm sort of in my mid to late 30s, US tech stocks, which are still undervalued, the S&P 500, for example, is about, I believe it's roughly 600 points from its record high. It's never not re-achieved its record high in the past. And therefore, while this isn't investing advice, if you have a very long time frame, just buying a good index tracker and waiting out the dip is a pretty good way to look at investing. If you're looking at short-term profits, so like trading, gold, I think, because the US, I think it's complex because gold obviously has an inverse relationship with US dollar. So the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, has said he's going to continue to increase interest rates. The markets are saying, no, you're not. Rates are going to be lower by the end of this year than what they are now. So if you're looking at investing in gold, if you're buying gold now, what you're saying is, even though it's at its record high or very near its record high, it's going to go higher because interest rates on the US dollar are going to go lower by the end of the year. So do you believe Jerome Powell or not? And obviously, again, we're coming back to this, where is the next Black Swan event? Where is the next big thing that's going to crack in the US and make them say, right, we're going to pause or pivot? I don't know where that's going to come from, in the same way as I didn't know that Silicon Valley Bank would collapse.
No.
It is interesting. I mean, if you look at those two banks in isolation, Silicon Valley Bank, which is a very bad management because they didn't hedge out their interest rate exposure, but they also chose to sell off their part of their bond portfolio and to raise equity on the same day that Silvergate Crypto Bank crashed. So invested connected the two events, so also very unlucky. If you look at Credit Suisse, this is a bank that has been plagued by regulatory dilemmas and billions of dollars of fines. I think at some point it was always going to go under. So it might be the Silicon Valley Bank, you know, it was a one-off thing potentially. And Credit Suisse, it might be that you've lanced a boil, so to speak. And actually going forward, that's going to strengthen the financial system because it's been a problem or a thorn in the side. of global bankers for a long time. And that's not to, you know, disparage the people who work there. And obviously at all levels, a lot of them very hardworking, very capable people. But the reality is that Credit Suisse as an institution has just constantly made mistakes, been fined, lots of issues. And now it's gone. It might end up being a good thing. But again, as I say, the problem is that when you're looking at history and you're looking at 2008, for example, there was a good 8 months between when Bear Stearns collapsed and when Lehman Brothers collapsed. So, and in that period, for a large portion of that period, the markets went up.
Yeah.
So you're seeing this now, and you've got to, well, it may not be history repeating itself, but history often rhymes with the stock market. And you've got a lot of people saying, well, we've dealt with the problems. They were two isolated problems, which they could very well be, and therefore it'll be fine. But it's interesting to note that whenever you have one or two bank failures, there's almost always more afterwards in history.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's very true, because not long after all that was going on, it seems to have gone away now, was, of course, we all thought Deutsche Bank was going to go bust over the weekend, and that kind of just, that news kind of just disappeared. But we were talking earlier, weren't we, about the Cabessi letter, who is someone on Twitter here who I follow, put some very good analysis out. And at the end of one of the recent tweets, he said, history says that bank failures come in large batches, which we have not yet seen in 2023. But taking those two failures, SVB and Signature Bank, total of $319 billion in assets, and he made a comparison to 2007-2014, where 500 banks collapsed in that time, for total inflation adjusted of $960 billion. So there's a heck of a lot more at stake. That's probably because of all the extra cash is in the system, isn't it, as well? So we're probably right. More is going to come out. More is going to come out of the wash.
Well, it's also the speed that you can, with bank runs, in particular, the speed at which social media you can withdraw. I mean, I have a sizable amount, for example, in my business bank account with a fintech, because they're just more useful. If I got a hint that they might be going under, I can press a button, all that money's gone.
Yeah.
Whereas in the past, this is genuinely true, when there were bank runs on regional banks in the US, what they used to do is when you had to go into the branch offices to withdraw your money, and they would say that there was a problem with the form that you signed or whatever to make you do it again. And therefore, they'd reduce the speed at which the money was exiting the accounts. Now you can have billions leave in a matter of minutes, which makes it much harder to control.
Okay.
I mean, if you look at US earnings season, see Goldman Sachs on their investment banking front, they've not done particularly well by historical standards. Regional banks, you're seeing massive outflows of cash. But this has been a trend that's been going on since long, long before Silicon Valley Bank. Thousands and thousands of regional banks have just gone under, and their money's been swallowed up by the titans. You might find it's the case that 10 years from now, there's just a few larger banks. The problem that you have with that, with the US in particular, and it's kind of alien to the UK, because obviously most people have an account with one of the big four and maybe one of the fintechs, and that's it. Whereas the US has a good 4,000 regional banks, and they do about 70% of the local lending. And so if all of that money goes into like the larger branches of the larger banks, you'll find that the economy becomes more static, because you need those regionals to lend out to smaller businesses, because they have an understanding of which businesses they can lend to on like a personalized level. Whereas if you're like going to a bank like JP Morgan, they'll say, okay, so how much money do you have? What's your credit rating? And like, they'll just do it by the numbers. And we haven't had that kind of personalized banking in the UK in a very long time. In fact, I can't remember the last time I went into branch for any reason other than to cash in coins.
Yeah. You don't even have to do checks anymore like you used to.
No, it's all on the app. But I wonder how dangerous that is, because we now have a society whereby all of your financial worth is just strings of code on a computer. It's not underpinned by gold or the dollar or anything else. And I don't know. I mean, I'm not kind of like a crazy disaster person, but for example, How can the money have value if it's just computer code? You know, what the difference between like sterling, even though yes, it may be underpinned by the government, and say Bitcoin, for example, if they're both just different types of computer code? I don't know, but it's something to think about anyway.
Something to think about for sure. Yeah, there's something nice about having gold sovereigns in your hand, or if you can afford it, gold Britannias, or indeed silver. There's something very tangible about that value there. You mentioned there the regionals. Why is money outflowing, do you think, from those ones? Is it because they're becoming insolvent, or
it's just fear, essentially, is what it is.
It's general kind of small scale bank runs. Okay.
Well, it's combined with the FDIC insurance. So in the US, your money is insured up to $250,000 per institution. Recent events suggest that in practice it's unlimited insurance, but in theory, right now your limit is $250,000. In the UK, the FSCS will protect up to £85,000 per banking license. That's really important, by the way, not per bank, per banking license, and they can have multiple brands. But the key thing is that if you've got over $250,000 and you're in the US in cash in your bank account, if that bank goes under, you'll lose all your money. So I think rather than people closing all of their accounts, what's actually happening is that the money that's over that limit is going into the larger banks, like JP Morgan, for example, or HSBC. Because they feel
safer.
Yes, they are considered safer. And they also just realistically, and again, this is not investing advice, they just are safer. Because if Joe Bloggs Bank somewhere in San Francisco with a few thousand customers goes under, then that's not going to crash the global economy. Yeah. Whereas if HSBC goes under, then we'd have a massive, massive problem. And every government in the world would ensure that would never happen. Or, for example, it'd be like a Credit Suisse situation, which was system critical. They just got UBS to buy it. Yeah. Very cheaply, without any due diligence whatsoever. And, I'm sure that's not to come back and bite us in the next couple of months, but you know.
Probably, yeah. But do you think then now, of course, we've had the rising interest rates we talk about, savers will be happy because they'll be getting letters that their interest rates are finally going up. If they've got money in the bank, they've been suffering for many, many, many years not having any interest there. But do you think this is also banks wanting to attract capital into the banks themselves? People, they want actually money inflows because they're concerned about money outflows.
100%. And then on top of that, one thing that a lot of people don't, I don't want to use the word understand, but they may simply just not know, is that fiat currency is created by the banks when they lend the money out.
Yes, yeah.
Not by the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England or the Reserve Bank of Australia or whatever. It doesn't matter. It's the same pretty much everywhere all over the world. So when you've had quantitative easing, which is essentially printing digital money, excess digital money, there was no real need to have customer deposits backing the money that you were loaning out. Whereas now you having quantitative tightening in the US, the UK and elsewhere, and therefore you have to have more customer deposits to back the loans that you're lending out in order to protect yourself against any potential bank runs. And obviously that's hitting the regionals more than the larger banks. But there is the case now that money now has value again. We were talking offline just before we jumped on about sort of if you're like trading the stock markets. And I was saying that if you previously, if you had say £10,000 and you wanted to invest or trade with it, if you put between 2008 and 2021, if you left it in an account, it would pretty much ensure that inflation would reduce the value of the money that you had in your account. Now you can get a sort of 4%, 5%, even 6% returns if you know where you look, guaranteed. Obviously, inflation will whittle away at it anyway. But the point is that if you're investing or trading with cash, not only are you risking the money that you're investing or trading with, you're also losing that guaranteed returns of just leaving it in a savings account, which never used to exist. Well, until prior to 2008.
Yeah, exactly. So it's going to be it's going to be harder to get any money off the sidelines. It's already difficult to get money off the sidelines and into companies looking to raise, but it's going to become even more difficult. As you say, if you've got a guaranteed return.
Well, I think it's a good reset of the system. It's maybe not a bad thing, especially since the pandemic. You have a lot of zombie companies with a lot of debt who are just kind of trickling along, and you might find that. I think you know, my own personal perspective is that when I'm investing into a company, you're getting people prepping proper research into ensuring that they're going to have a good rate of return. That sort of 5% the return they could have a guaranteed is worth risking it. You're bringing a premium of risk back into the markets, so you're reducing the level of overvaluations. And then on top of that, you're probably going to get less volatility because you're going to have fewer people going short or going long because the value of money has come back into the markets. I certainly hope so anyway, but then But then obviously you make these predictions and 3 months later, China invades Taiwan anyway and the whole thing goes to hell.
The whole thing goes to hell, yeah.
Well.
But I was reading, so I just, as you see chatter, as you scroll through, you know, Twitter, etc. I was reading chatter that money was sort of, from fear of bank runs, money was sort of going to big tech stocks, you know, like Apple, for example, because they've got a business behind it. They've got a heck of a lot of money in the bank. So why not almost use buying Apple stock as a bank, effectively, and park your money there? And then only, was it at the weekend or just a few days ago, Apple have now announced you can actually bank with them for 4.5%. So they're turning into a bank.
Well, I think, well, it's a 4.15%. I think it's interesting because that's very close to a market leading rate. It's obviously very easy to access that rate, especially if you have like an iPhone or a Mac. And yes, you can get a slightly higher rate of returns if you're in the US, if you go into like the money markets, but the majority of people are not going to do that. So it may be with Apple 4.15%, it may be this is a precursor to them as a company considering getting into the stock market trading apps themselves. But I do think that 4.15%, that kind of a return is going to make them very, very, what's the word I'm looking for here? Attractive, attractive to current account holders. And the thing is as well with Apple is that they've got this very large contingent of very loyal people who will always use Apple products if there's one on offer. And I see this, like, for example, my wife is like this. She has a MacBook and an iPhone and everything else. Doesn't need these things because the vast majority of people don't need a MacBook for the day-to-day work. But it's something where you think, well, this is something that I've always used. It works really well and it's worth the premium. You might find that with the Apple account that they've launched, you're going to have a lot of people saying exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
It's just works. It's easier. And Apple just have this uncanny ability to create UX, a user experience, which is just better than anybody else. Mm. So I'm sure they've spent, you know, millions researching and making sure that it works perfectly.
Yeah.
And I think we've all had that experience with, especially like legacy banking apps, where you're trying to pay a bill or log online and they want you to type things in and do things that are annoying. I think one key thing about it, from like a user perspective, that hasn't been discussed, but I think will be really interesting with the Apple accounts. So if you're in the UK, right, and you'll have experienced this already, when you're trying to buy something from a shop, 8 times out of 10, it will ask you to log into your banking app, right, to approve the purchase or get a one-time passcode or whatever else. If you're buying something on an iPhone, it'll just be your thumbprint, because they say that security is good enough. And therefore, it'll be so much easier to buy stuff if you're using an iPhone with an Apple account. And therefore, they're going to take the market by storm.
Yeah. Well, why not?
Maybe.
Good for them.
Well, why not? The problem is they've had so much money just sort of sloshing around. There's only so many times you can advance the iPhone or exactly. the Mac. This is a way for them to make more money with the money they have.
Exactly. Well, we've talked about quite a few things there. I know I'd probably like to talk to you again at some point. We can talk about perhaps the general cost of living situation, housing, and what's going on with housing and rent prices, that kind of thing. But I mean, just a few closing thoughts, maybe from you, Charles. You're going for small cap AIM stock. That's where you see the value, the potential in the short term.
I think so. I think that, I'll be completely honest with you. So when I have excess income, which is most months, 50% of it roughly goes into my SIP, so private pension, and it's invested into, I think it's a Vanguard S&P 500 tracker, and that's my pension taken care of. And I don't worry about it. It just goes in every month, and that's that. And then, you know, to become a millionaire in the next couple of years or billionaire or whatever else, I go for the FTSE AIM small cap stocks, because those are the companies which are historically undervalued, where there's very little analysis or research, and therefore where you don't have that many people who understand what they have.
Okay.
So a couple of my most successful investments, Premier African Minerals, Kodal Minerals. Premier African Minerals invested in mid-September 2019. It was trading for 0.03p. It's been hovering around a whole penny now, 3.5 years later. And that's because they have access rights to this massive block of lithium in Zimbabwe, which is almost certainly going to bring them huge amounts of profits and a likely buyout. But again, with that company, very few people saw what was going to happen or where it was going to go when they got access to those rights. And it's the same with Kodal Minerals. And I think it's the same. The other sector that I look at other than commodities is biotech stocks.
Okay.
So one that I think is really promising at the moment is Avacta, which are attempting, they're in the latter stages of phase 1A of their flagship trial candidate, which is AVA6000. They've tested 19 patients so far, and the results are really, really good. And the idea is hopefully they're going to go for chemotherapy without any side effects. Now, traditionally, the stats are that these kind of where they are at the moment with their trial with AVA6000, phase 1A, 90% of them fail. So only 10% succeed. But what they're doing is they're modifying an existing treatment called doxorubicin. And therefore, the success rate could be higher than what the market is currently predicting. The problem is with these small cap stocks is that you're relying on limited research and limited analysis from a lot of people, including myself, who don't have access to all of the data,
mm-hmm.
and who are, and therefore there is a good chance that you could lose all of your money. But then when the risks are so high, the rewards are also exponentially higher, and therefore it's worth going for it, in my opinion.
Well, I'm sure we could also do a podcast at some point where we talk about stocks as well and get your opinion on
joys.
Some of the valuations there. But that's been a good introduction. Thank you very much for giving us your time today, Charles.
I'm more than happy to give my time to you, Mark. It's nice to be on Stockbox and, you know, have my voice heard, and hopefully I haven't rambled on too long.
No, it's been good. Thank you very much.
Perfect. Okay. Bye then.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
CODA salutes those who served. Veterans ride free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of CODA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use CODA Plus. Veterans ride free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on CODA. Plan your ride and learn more at coda.com/trip planner.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.